Welcome to a PDI podcast. I'm your host, Mark Oliver Wright, Clinical Science Liaison for the Central Region. With me today is Dr. Janet Haas, PhD, RN, CIC, FSHA, FAPIC, who is the President and CEO at Innovative Infection Prevention. She was the former Director of Epidemiology at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York, New York. She was President of APIC in 2018, and is an associate editor of the American Journal of Infection Control. Dr. Haas has authored the hand hygiene chapter of the APIC text, as well as several peer-reviewed publications in the field of infection prevention and control. Her research interests include hand hygiene, environmental disinfection, and computer-aided surveillance. Welcome, Dr. Haas.
Hi there. Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm happy to be here today.
You know, we met early in our infection prevention careers with similar interests in informatics, but, you know, that introduction that I just read leaves out one of the coolest things I know about your background. You were a union construction worker in the New York region before pursuing a career in nursing and ultimately infection prevention, right?
Yep, that's true. It's one of those maybe little known facts, but I'm really grateful that I had that experience because I think that knowledge is never wasted and transferable into anything else that you do. It makes for a lifelong learner, which I am proud that I am and I think is demanded of more of us as time goes on. And I was a millwright, which is a precision mechanical trade that gets to work on a lot of different kinds of projects. And I think in that way, it's similar to infection prevention because we're involved in every part of the hospital and every aspect of patient care, facilities management, cleaning, disinfection. So in that way, it's a similarly broad range of skills that is needed to be a millwright, as is in infection control in the hospital and healthcare setting. So in fact, I spent a significant amount of time working in sewage treatment plants and know how those get put together and how they get made and how they work. And now when we talk about infection prevention topics like antibiotic resistance and surveying that in sewage treatment facilities, I feel like I have some knowledge on both ends of the microbiology and antibiotic resistance spectrum.
Yeah, millwrights and infection preventionists, we're both jack of all trades, right?
That's true, but I hope that we're masters.
I hope we're masters as well. Well, let's rewind the clock a little bit. So in early 2020, you were the program director of epidemiology at Lenox Hill on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. You had just finished your tenure on the APIC board as past president, which is a huge commitment over many years. Do you recall when you first heard about a new coronavirus, what your thoughts were?
So I think that we were probably taken more by surprise than we should have been. We knew that we had a couple of isolated cases coming through in some places in the West. And I think maybe we were a little complacent because of our successful management of the Ebola crisis that it didn't really materialize into a full-fledged pandemic. But I really started to pay attention in the end of January. I was giving a career day presentation for my daughter's seventh grade class. And it was on being an epidemiologist and infectious diseases. And I had a really great presentation about an outbreak among middle schoolers who were on a class trip, which I don't know if it will be relevant, you know, anytime soon. But the kids were really getting into it. And then I said, well, what kind of thing are you hearing about now? And that was January 30th. And that was all over the papers in New York. I think it must have been the first case identified either in New York or the first case of known transmission in the United States. I can't remember which, but we really started thinking about it more seriously at that time. And I think, you know, in hindsight, we had so much to learn from peers in China before then. And if we had it to do over again, I think we would have benefited from really learning from that experience and taking that very much to heart earlier than anybody did in the U.S. And now we're finding out that there were some politics involved in that in terms of what people knew and what people wanted to disclose and the amount of transparency of these public health issues.
So as the situation escalated in and around the New York region, can you describe for us what a typical day in the life was for you and your colleagues?
Yeah, so we started off at Lenox Hill. So first of all, Lenox Hill Hospital is a part of Northwell Health System, which is a 23 hospital system in New York, and it's largely in downstate in the Long Island area and with Manhattan and some places in Westchester County. So the southern part of the state, but it is the largest employer in all of New York State and has a huge number of hospitals. So communication among participants and healthcare workers in an organization of that size is huge. And communication just on the hospital level is hugely important as well. So we started each day with a leadership huddle where we got for Lenox Hill Hospital the most up-to-date information from our system. And then other leaders at our hospital were privy to meetings at the system level and cascaded that information. And I think one of the good things for us as a hospital was we went to the leadership meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning, every day of the week, virtually on Saturday and Sunday and in person at first. During the week. And then again, at 4 o'clock, we debriefed on what happened during the day and what was going on. And then the expectation was that that information had to be cascaded to everyone's staff members. So nursing had a huddle after the leadership huddle, where the nurse managers were briefed on everything that was said in the leadership huddle. And then they were expected to cascade that during their team huddles on the floor. And that was really very important to keep people knowledgeable about what was going on, what the expectations were, what was coming next, if there were shortages in PPE, what we were doing about it. You know, expect to see yellow gowns instead of blue disposable gowns because we couldn't get our hands on more blue disposable gowns, but they're equivalent and this is how you use them. So some anticipatory guidance there. We were also lucky that as services closed in the spring, like our surgical services. Nobody was furloughed at that time. They were all redeployed. So we had N95 fit testing center was staffed so that people could get refit tested as we had to change N95 brands. And we in infection prevention had a cadre of OR nurses who were pretty skilled at PPE donning and doffing that were floating throughout our building 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, day shift and night shift, to help people with how to put on and take off their PPE, what things we were reusing, how to store the things that were being reused, and what things they shouldn't be reusing, where to get additional supplies, and so on. So that was really, really key to the success, I think, of the infection prevention piece in our hospital. And to really helping the IP staff to not be overwhelmed with everything. So we could go out and do what had to be support the staff members, but also knew that on Saturday night at midnight, there was somebody on site who could help out the staff members. We also were in this race to get expanded areas built because we knew we were going to have this wave of patients. And our governor made an edict that, you know, you had to increase your capacity by 50% over the course of a week. So just think about that for a moment. And we did it. So our facilities people, our construction contractors, so this wasn't even just hospital teams. We couldn't have done it with just the hospital teams, but the contractors who were frequently working with us in the hospital on various projects got all redeployed to making additional bed capacity for the expected numbers of patients that we were going to see. So areas that had been patient care units, but were turned into offices and storage areas and all that got cleaned out and reactivated. The HVAC system was was assessed to see how much negative pressure we could get. Could we get certain areas to turn them into negative pressure for the people who needed the high-flow nasal oxygen or other high-risk aerosol-generating kind of procedures? And so that was quite something. You know, the ICRA process kind of flew out the window and people just did the best that they could. And we were really lucky that our contractors were very used to what our requirements were. So so they knew what the expectations were and tried to keep that up to the greatest extent possible while we were, you know, preparing for this surge. And we had maybe a little bit of capability in that the other services were shutting down. So for example, we turned our ambulatory surgery PACU into an extension of our emergency department so that we could separate the suspect COVID from the people who didn't have COVID or weren't suspected of having COVID, and separate those two so they weren't sitting in waiting rooms together and so on and having exposure risk within the care setting. And since the ambulatory surgery wasn't happening, the timing of that was easier than when the services were going on at full force. And that just went on through much of March. We learned a lot about infrastructure. We had a day in which I think everybody on leadership's, you know, life lost 10 years of life when we were using so much oxygen that the pipes were freezing as the oxygen was going through the pipes. That was the, you know, the sharp uptick in use of oxygen. So I don't know, because I'm not there any longer, if the oxygen truck is still parked outside of the building, but I got to tell you, I wouldn't be surprised if that doesn't go away in anytime soon, because, you know, there was a lot of PTSD around what if we lose that capability with so many patients who need it. Yeah. And the staff, you know, had to be resilient, and it was really great to have the extra sets of hands in terms of our nursing and other colleagues whose service lines were shut down to help get oxygen to everybody just in case and so on, you know, to make sure that the care flowed consistently. And then the other thing that was really good is that everybody found ways to find the yes in getting the patients what they needed. So as I said, it's a 23 hospital system, and two of those hospitals were in the epicenter of the epicenter out in Queens, and they were just quickly getting overwhelmed. And so there were meetings at the system level to figure out how to reroute some of these patients so that they could get the care they needed at one of the sister hospitals, rather than go without care, without an ICU bed, without appropriate critical care staff to manage their care. So all of that was happening, and maybe people remember that there was the Javits Center was opened for patients, but with very strict criteria on the level of care needed, and it had to be pretty much ready for discharge. And then the Navy ship came and didn't take very many people. So a lot of effort went into coordinating transfer of patients to an alternate level of care so that we could free up acute care beds for the patients who really were in acute state and needed that level of care. And we really also learned how to manage patients at home better with support, pulse oximetry, and so on, so that if they were not ill enough to require hospitalization, they could still get the support that they need and the check-in that they needed, so that if they started to decompensate, there was somebody to call and a way for them to get quickly into the hospital when they needed to have an increase in level of care. So it was really something. It was really pretty all-consuming, and I feel for all of our colleagues who are experiencing this all over the country right now.
Yeah, finding the yes in the setting of a crisis, that seems like a highly coordinated and adaptive experience. What was the single greatest challenge that you faced as the situation dragged on?
So I think we were really, really lucky. I think PPE was a very big challenge. We never got to the point where we didn't have ventilators or staff to manage these patients. We never got to the point where in our health system there wasn't the drug that we thought would be useful. Now, you know, we've come ahead several months. No more about this, but if we thought we needed remdesivir and it was in short supply, one of the other hospitals might have a dose and somebody would heroically drive through traffic, or there wasn't as much traffic then because everything was shut down, but to go to wherever that was to get that for the patient. So I think that there was a lot of mental health strain for the frontline caregivers, and we had to do a lot to try and help support them. And the availability of PPE and the constant changes in what supplies were available to us, and in there was a period of time in which the recommendations coming from CDC and the state and others were changing day by day. So that was really tough to try to educate people to something, and then tomorrow it changes, and keeping up the level of trust that's required when people are really tense and we don't know if we're going to get our hands on more N95s and we are putting them in harm's way. And make no mistake, the people who are doing this work on the front lines are putting themselves in harm's way, because anybody could get sick with this, and hopefully it's, you know, not a bad disease process and you recover for most people, but healthcare workers are people too and have their own underlying conditions and so on. So we really worked out the things we were asking of our frontline staff and how to support them and make sure that they had the right PPE and products that they needed just to keep them safe, as well as managing through our large system to get everything that the patients needed.
You know, that's a really great segue, because I'm curious about how this will impact healthcare professionals in general, but specifically infection preventionists. You know, when we did the first APIC mega survey about 5 years ago, something close to 1 in 5 respondents said they were planning to retire in the next few years. Do you think that this pandemic has changed that? And if so, in what direction?
So I think that, you know, there's good and bad in everything. And so I think the people who were going to retire after a lifetime of service will probably continue to do that, although I think in places where somebody is an N of one, you know, there's one single IP in their department, people feel really loyal to their institutions and their colleagues and their patients, and so they may defer their retirement a little bit. On the other side, I think that maybe institutions are seeing that having some redundancy or at least a plan for succession is really important in ways that maybe they let things slide a little bit in the past. And, you know, Dr. Tanya Bubb and I put out a crowdsourced survey of infection preventionists, because I think that we're a small enough group that when people talk about frontline providers, they're thinking about doctors and nurses and, you know, respiratory therapists and paramedics, but infection preventionists are sort of in a different category and may not be the subject of anybody else's research. So we sort of have to do it ourselves. And so we asked IPs over from the beginning of March, like March 8th to the middle of July, about what their experience was and how are they feeling about their situation. And many people felt, of course, stressed, somewhat overwhelmed, but also they felt more of a sense of teamwork and camaraderie than they had in the past. That's what they reported to us. And few of them said that they were, you know, emotionally exhausted and drained for prolonged periods of time. So maybe 1 week was bad, but the next week they kind of felt better about things. And they felt that this pandemic has elevated the role of the infection preventionist to be more recognized as an expert and a leader in their facility. So hopefully that portends that our profession will be seen at that leadership level in a different way as a result of people really showing up every day and working the 70-hour weeks and being there for the frontline staff when they were seen as crucial, necessary to help people stay safe and get them through this. I think that, you know, we know that the psychology of hand hygiene and other things is if it seems like it's a risk to ourselves, we respond differently than if we think it's a risk to somebody else. And so I think with so many people thinking that this is a risk to themselves as healthcare workers, they want and need the interventions and expertise of the infection preventionists in their facilities. So hopefully it's a good thing. And we'll just have to see if burnout becomes a factor over time as this continues. I think in New York, we were really lucky that we were seen as heroes, you know, healthcare heroes was sort of how we were approached. And people, I don't know if you've seen on the news, but at 7 o'clock every night, people were coming out of their apartments and banging pots and pans and yelling and screaming and clapping to support the healthcare workers taking care of these record numbers of patients. And I think people heard about the refrigerator trucks that were outside of every hospital and funeral home because there were so many fatalities as a result of COVID. So that puts a strain on people, and sadly, they're pulling them back. You know, they left the hospitals in New York City, and it was just such a moving feeling for all of us at the hospital the day that they pulled the last of those trucks. We had two of them out of the street by our hospital, and I'm so overwhelmingly sad that we couldn't, as a country, learn from that experience and not to have to live it everywhere. And in New York, they're starting to put those trucks back in place outside of the hospitals again, and it's just it's just unfortunate. So I mean, I think that in the spring we felt like if we could get through this wave together, we could move on to other things, and that people would learn from that event. How this will play out as this all goes on and on throughout the whole country now is anybody's guess. Wow. I'm hoping that it will be recognized as experts, though.
Me too. I hope we find that silver lining. Dr. Haas, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your experience. Thank you as well for your service, not just to your former organization during this crisis, but to the field of infection prevention through your many contributions over the years. We at PDI wish you and everyone a happy, healthy, and safe holiday season.
So thanks, Mark. If people want to take part in our survey that we've just relaunched, they can find the link at www.innovativeinfectionprevention.com. And we're trying to make it so that everyone who participates will have access to a dashboard to see not only what they're saying, but how others are feeling at this time. And maybe that can give people a little bit of support and that they know that they're not going through this alone. And other people are having a shared experience.
Perfect. Thank you. And thank you for joining us for another PDI podcast.